It's a great pleasure to give this second lecture, and you're very precise about starting on time here, which I certainly appreciate. And I think the last lecture was quite theoretical. It laid out some basic ideas. But in this lecture, I will talk about the structure of economic sociology and its development over time. So the lecture is called Economic Sociology, Uncertainty as a Bridge Between Economics and Sociology. So I will in this lecture analyze new economic sociology, which is a field, for short, is concerned with the understanding of economy using sociological approaches and sociological tools. In this sense, it's very similar to other fields, such as cultural sociology, military sociology, or political sociology, each of which also has a specific domain of study to which the sociological apparatus is employed. Economic sociology must, much like sociology at large actually, be understood in relation to economics. Classic sociologists addressed other economic issues than economists and developed alternative approaches to the economy. And they thereby also distanced themselves from economic reasoning. Furthermore, the contemporary economic sociology, which is called New Economic Sociology, very fantastic name, is partly critique of economics, or more specifically about a critique of neoclassical economics. Though, of course, some of the critique that has been voiced by economic sociologists is valid, and many good empirical or theoretical works have been presented, this strategy of new economic sociology has not led to much discussion that furthers collaboration or even rational conversation in the Habermasian sense with economists. My strategy to further economic sociology is a radically different one. I propose the concept of uncertainty as a common base for both economics and economic sociology. And this lecture aims at making the argument that economic sociology should focus on industries addressing the question of uncertainty. Thereby, I claim, I will not only make a distinct contribution to our understanding of the economy, but also facilitate a rational and productive conversation between economics and sociology. For those of you attending the first lecture, you may recall that the notion of uncertainty was central. This lecture includes thus a short summary of the notion of uncertainty, but focuses on how it leads to practical research, questions for economists, and particularly, of course, for new economic sociologists. Or for short, sociologists. In economics, uncertainty is not a controversial concept. As a matter of fact, it's already a basic concept since almost 100 years ago. In sociology, uncertainty has been used by some, albeit in different ways, but cannot yet be seen as a basic concept. My argument is that the concept lends itself well as a basic concept also in sociology. It can, and I argue, be used in economic sociological studies to improve both theoretical and empirical work. So in the first part of the lecture, I'll present what is known as new economic sociology, starting with its historical development, leading up to its current standing. The next section of the lecture offers a critical assessment of this tradition. Finally, I outline the way the notion of uncertainty can be used in a productive way to form an integrative analysis of economic phenomena by doing studies of entire industry using sociological tools. So the paths to economic sociology. The short story is that sociologists since the dawn of the discipline have been interested in the economy. But it was only in the 1980s that this research topic was reappearing as central in sociology. At that point in time, American sociologists, primarily, who had this interest in economic phenomena, came together in what perhaps best can be described as a social movement, with some leading figures, most notably Mark Ronovetter, and I would certainly like to add his supervisor, Harrison White. And this social movement gradually organized itself and became institutionalized as new economic sociology. And this has been shown by Richard Swidwer, for example, in his work Principles of Economic Sociology from 2003. But let us start with the classic economic sociology before returning to this new economic sociology. Of course, history has no beginning, and it's possible to include even Adam Smith or Karl Marx as predecessors to classic sociology or classic economic sociology. But for my purpose, it makes little sense to go beyond those who generally are seen as founding fathers in economic sociology. Classic economic sociology was not a separate branch of sociology. Instead, it was integrated and central to sociology. However, the founding fathers of sociology, Durkheim, Weber, Simmel, and Pareto, in addition to Marx, are also the founding fathers of economic sociology. Durkheim's The Division of Labor and Society, Simmel's Philosophy of Money, and Weber's Economy and Society are still considered to be among the most influential contributions to economic sociology. Smelz and Swedberg called these works remarkable because of their pioneering spirit and how they analyzed the economy in society, outlining the difference between sociological analysis and economic matters, and that analysis of economists. And of course, also to their contribution to our understanding of economic action. But there is no clear line from this successful, the beginning of the classic economic sociology to its contemporary version. What happened after World War I, which of course is ended 100 years ago, and the encounter with economics is often described as a fragmentation of sociology in a multitude of subdomains. Richard Swedberg, who is a kind of the person who has written most extensively on the history of economic sociology and also been part of constituting the field, has studied the development of economic sociology, and he says in year 1987 already, the main trend in sociology after World War I was to develop various subfields, and somehow economic sociology got lost in the process. A series of specialized areas appeared which were concerned with some aspects of the economy, calling, for example, industrial sociology, consumer sociology, sociology of professions, and stratification studies. No subfield, however, was developed for dealing with the economy as a whole, according to Swedberg. During the period mentioned by Swedberg, we can observe a shift from Europe to US as the center of sociological development. It's true that only a few works, some of which still matters to economic sociology, were published during these years. It's perhaps interesting to see that those works which are cited by economic sociologists were primarily written by non-sociologists, Schumpeter and Polanyi. Schumpeter shares the broad view that Weber outlined in his Grundriss, of which economy and society is a part, namely to get a full understanding of economic phenomena, one should combine, Schumpeter says, economic theory, economic history, statistics and statistical methods, and economic sociology. This suggests it was never turned into proper research agenda or research paradigm. Polanyi's work has had an impact in several disciplines, but it was only via the reintroduction of notion of embeddedness by Mark Ronnevetter in 1985 that Polanyi was truly rediscovered in economic sociology. Or in sociology. However, Ronnevetter was never influenced by Polanyi. I don't think even he read Polanyi. The only sociological work that was published and that has become part of the tradition was written by Parsons and Smelzer. Obviously there were a lot of texts published, but this has had a big impact. And here, of course, I'm referring much more to the US tradition of economic sociology. I'm well aware there is a French one, but I think when we speak about economic sociology, the constitution of the field is primarily something that happened in the US. So their work, Parsons and Smelzer's work, drawing on Parsons' analysis of classical economists, Alfred Marshall and Vilfredo Pareto, and the sociologists Max Weber and Emil Durkheim, developed in the direction of system analysis. Parsons continued the ambition of classic thinkers to address larger issues. In Europe, the classic heritage was used most extensively in Germany and France. But it was in the US that the new economic sociology was born, but not out of Parsons' work. Parsons, most likely influenced by Pareto, argued for a clear boundaries between the disciplines. Economics should take care of what he calls the analytic factor view, meaning that it should study, and I quote, the allocation of means in the means and chain that constitutes human behavior, while, and he says, sociology would concentrate on the value factor, ultimately common ends and the attitude associated with and underlying them, end of quote. Later, Parsons revised this view, and this so-called Parsons Pact was invented in favor of a more integrative approach to economics and sociology. But because of Parsons, the notion of economic sociology was dropped in favor of a broader and perhaps less threatening idea of economy and society, threatening then in relation to economics, I would say, which reinforces the separation between the economy and the rest of society that already Weber assumed in his work, Wirtschaft und Gesellschaft, Economy and Society. The period between classic economic sociology and the 1970s produced relatively few sociological works that have later been cited by economic sociologists. Guillain and others say that during the 1960s, many studies related to market production were conducted in adjacent fields, for example, organization theory and work and occupation. During this era, studies of economic growth in developing countries and the new comparative political economy were more characteristic of the field. In the 70s and the 1980s, organization theory played a role. Yet other fields, like sociology of work and occupation, the focus was directed towards issues of stratification, class, occupational hierarchies, status, and income distribution. Other domains of interest were the sociology of development, studying industrialization and economic growth, and the sociology of culture, developing close connection to the flourishing domain of anthropology in the 60s and 1970s. It is clear that though economic issues were seen as relevant, as well as the outcomes of markets, the economy itself, its core institutions, and the relations of these core institutions were not seriously addressed by economics, by sociologists. And obviously, or perhaps more clearly, these studies were never labeled economic sociology. The Granovetter and Svedberg referred to these studies as the old sociology of economic life. So no matter what studies one mentioned, it's clear that it was not until the 1980s that a new era in the history of the economic sociology movement began. So I now turn to new economic sociology. And I think it's against this background that we should read the new economic sociology. It's called new economic sociology, starting in the 1980s, has by and large been a successful story. It has led to many important studies. Its scholars are working at the most prestigious university on both sides of the Atlantic, and it has attracted many young doctoral candidates. It's today a firmly institutionalized tradition of research, with research groups at many universities in many countries, such as France, Germany, UK, Sweden, and the Netherlands. So new economic sociology was established as a result of sociological work on core economic institutions. Spearheaded by the network analysis of Harrison White, the supervisor Mark Granovetter, the most leading economic sociologist, sociologists had a set of great tools at the disposal for the analysis of the economy. The empirical domain that was targeted using the network approach was markets, both by Granovetter in 1974 and White in 1981. The market is in many ways the most central economic institution, but somewhat paradoxically, an institution that economists, at least in the early 1980s, took, and to some extent still today, take for granted. White developed a mathematical theory about producer markets, drawing on the works of Edward Chamberlain and Alfred Marshall, and producer markets, in contrast to markets in which objects are exchanged, such as stock exchange, is of a different kind, White argues, and claimed that economists only had a theory of these stock exchanges. And of course, this is correct in the sense that both Alfred Marshall and Leon Valeras, both of whom took really important part in the development of economics and neoclassical economics, were actually studying the real stock exchanges. And out of that, they developed their theories. But White speaks about producer markets. In these, the sellers are producers of cars, frozen pizzas, or whatever. The producers gain identity in relation to one another. But new economic sociology is a result of activities of many different people, all of whom turned their attention to the economy that increasingly was part of the center of attention during the economic liberalizations in the 1980s, led by political work of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So economic sociologists facing this tendency of economic liberalization, these economic sociologists were then in the 30s and 40s and still, academically speaking, quite young, and gradually came together, organized themselves, and published texts on the canon. They published readers, organized conference, but essentially continued to publish empirical work in the leading journals, such as American Journal of Sociology and American Sociological Review. And as a consequence, the field remained at the center of sociology and did not disappear as many other marginal subfields that have started their own journals. Today, the new economic sociology is institutionalized. In this lecture, I will present the four most notable economic sociological approaches, that is, networks, organization, culture, and performativity, These are discussed at great detail, for example, in the book I published, Reimagine Economic Sociology, from 2015, which I did with Nigel Dodd. But for quite some time, new economic sociology was viewed as composed of three main branches: network theory, new institutional organizational theory, and cultural sociology. A more recent approach that is distinct, that has primarily been used for analysis of financial markets, is performativity. I think it's fair to say that these traditions have their theoretical origin outside of the economy, and only later have they been employed and, of course, refined by economic sociologists to be used to study the economy. Each of these correlates, of these approaches, correlates with studies of certain issues, empirical issues. So the network approach. And if there is one approach that can claim to have been have primed the new economic sociology, especially from the onset, it's network theory. And this idea, of course, can be traced back to Simmel, but the main source of influence to sociology was structural anthropology. The central idea, in brief, of this structural approach is that the economic men are positioned in a network. This positioning, and more specifically, the unique ties they have to others, is seen as the main explanatory value of actors' undertaking. According to one interpretation of this condition, economic men are embedded in ties. According to this interpretation, decision of economic men are contingent on structural embeddedness, and explanations tend to focus on the structure of the networks and actors' position. So it's actually enough to understand the structure of the network to explain what people do. You don't really have to ask people. It's a very structural, almost deterministic model to some extent. According to a more far-reaching interpretation, human actors are even constituted by these ties. And the leading figure, both of formal network theory and later, interestingly enough, of the constitutional network theory, has been Harrison White. Though, as mentioned, it's clearly his student, Mark Granovetter, who has made a notion important and well-established in economic sociology, especially with his well-known article from 1985, which I will come back to. White's study, Chains of Opportunity, from 1970, on internal labor market, is the first prominent study of structural economic sociology. Granovetter's study, Getting a Job, that's his dissertation, published in 1974, shows how information about new job openings are in particular a function of the weak connections the actors have, the weak ties. The strength of weak ties is the title of the article he published a year earlier, which is extremely well cited. I will get back to that. So given the fact that both White and Granovetter started by addressing labor market, it's worth noting here that until this day, labor and labor markets have only been at the margin of economic sociological analysis. Not in sociology, but in economic sociological analysis, with relatively little contact with a field called labor market sociology and economic sociology. Generally speaking, there are today plenty of studies, of course, that have employed the notion of network, theoretically and empirically in economic sociology, in other fields of sociology, and in other scientific disciplines. It's also worth noting the tremendous importance the notion of network has had, both as a theoretical idea and as a mathematical method, is present in many texts. Network is certainly one thing that sociology, in particular economic sociology, has exported to economics. But not only to economics, the notion is commonly used, and we today speak about us networking as an activity. The organization approach. Organization has been a topic for sociological investigations since before the initiation of the new economic sociology. The oldest roots are bureaucracy, the theory of firms, and industrial sociology. But though many of the organizations previously studied by sociologists were economic, this was not specifically acknowledged, and organizations were not primarily, or even at all, studied for the insights they might provide for the sociology of economic life. It was only with the development of new economic sociology that organization studies changed from being focused largely on the internal coordination of organization to focus on the relation between organizations. That's a huge difference. And the plurality of organization structures. The major contribution of organization study has been the incorporation of power, interest, and meaning into the sociological analysis of the operation and change of organization. And today, much of the studies of firms are done by people employed at business schools, some of whom are sociologists, This research is on organizations, or rather on aspects of organizations. However, at the same time, the analysis and development of the ideas of the core of organization theory, which according to any standard is formal organization, has been somewhat neglected. To be a bit blunt, the more the field has been dominated by business scholars, the less we see a theory development of this core. Furthermore, the core notion, formal organization, has been dissolved due to an ongoing deconstructing of organization researchers. And this problem has recently been noted and debated in a book by Paul Dugay and Signe Wickelsjö, and it's called For Formal Organization, The Past in the Present Future of Organization from 2017. There are, of course, many, many exceptions, and I would like to highlight the works of Jörn Arne and Nils Brunson, two colleagues of mine, which represent an attempt to create a very solid theory of formal organizations. I now turn to the cultural approach. Network theory and most of the organization analysis are structural approaches, which put emphasis on relation between individuals and on structural formations on an aggregate level, such as within or between firms or organizations. At least institutional schools of organization theory often use similar tools as cultural sociologists, such as rules, scripts. The main proposition of the cultural approach to economic sociology is that all economic activities are embedded, not just in social structure, but also in culture. But as one of the school's leading proponents, Viviana Selitzer, puts it, while it's important not to see culture and market as hostile worlds, it's equally important not to be drawn into suggesting that markets are, she says, nothing but culture. Paul DiMaggio is another significant cultural economic sociologist, and DiMaggio has in a number of areas, including consumer behavior, shown that market exchange often is enmeshed in cultural-rich social networks. By doing historical research, he has shown that the creation of a high culture in the 19th century America was used by elites as a means of distinction. Mitchell Balafe is a third key figure in the culture approach. He was undertaking ethnographic research into financial markets before the field called Studies of Finance became established. In Making Markets from 1996, an old book, based on extensive fieldwork that started already in 1979, Abulafia explores the market subcultures among those trading stocks and various bonds. He argues, and I quote, rational maximization is not a fundamental human drive or instinct, but rather a social and culture-defined strategy derived from a repertoire of strategies that is interpreted in each market subculture. This is a typical idea of a cultural economic sociologist. There are some theoretical connections between the cultural approach to economic sociology, just as described, and the anti-utilitarian perspective that has been developed mainly in France. Of interest here is the work of Philip Steiner, who has published both on Mauss and on Durkheim, as well as critical engage with Selitzer's work that draws closely on the ideas by Polanyi. The performativity approach, and here, of course, we will return to France again. Performativity's most recent contribution to economic sociology and the ideas are rooted primarily in the French School of Science and Technology Studies. The concept has been particularly influential in the social studies of finance, but the idea of performativity is also found in many other areas, such as the broadly conceived sociology of markets and evaluation studies. The actor network theory, or for short, ANT, was introduced, as you may know, in economic sociology with a volume published in 1998 by Michel Callot, The Laws of the Market, in which contributions from, among others, Selitzer, Stark, and Granovetter appear. In the introduction, Callot writes that the volume centers on the claim that economics, and here I quote, performs, shapes, and formats the economy rather than observing how it functions, end of quote. The reference to performativity was made in relation to Garcia Perpé's study on the strawberry market. One non-French but still central study following up on the performativity thesis is Mackenzie-Miller's study, Constructing a Market, Performing a Theory. And there are obviously additional works that have discussed the material, technical side of the economy, including works on performativity of economic models by Mackenzie and market devices by Calon, Miller, and Fabian Munisa, as well as a volume edited by Swedberg and Pinch, Living in Material World. The most recent text is perhaps published by Donna McKenzie in American Journal of Sociology this year on high-frequency trading. So this is, I mean, in a sense, the received view of economic sociology up to still perhaps to this date. But how valid is it, and how far has it led economic sociology? If we make a critical assessment, what I'm about to do now, we can say, we'll see this more clearly. First of all, today, the field of economic sociology is clearly institutionalized on both sides of the Atlantic, the SASE, Society for the Advancement of Socioeconomics, and the American Sociological Association section on economic sociology, are organizations that today represent the backbone of the institutionalized economic sociology. I think there's no doubt that today much work is done using these four sociological traditions I just described. But if we look at these approaches, it's a network approach that has by far the largest impact. And we should take a closer look at this in terms of empirical evidence. And I prepared a few slides to show the citation structure of economic sociology over time. I mean, this you can't see. I will soon show you a blow up. But just to give you an indication, if you start up there, that's the first block, so to speak, with 10 texts, and here on the left-hand side. So this is the 1950s, and the next block is the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. And for each block, or each decade, here you have 10 texts, the most cited text of the decade. And you see here there is a pattern here that the most cite, here is the frequency of citation, and here we have 2,000 and there you have 6,000 citations. So you have, relatively speaking, one leading article in each decade. And then you have a number of others which are more closely related to one another. So it's a clear pattern. And now I show you a blow up that might give you some idea. So this is the 1970s and 1980s. You can say, from an economic sociological perspective, nothing happened during the 50s and 60s, as I kind of told you. Well, nothing happened, but I mean, yeah, you know what I mean. But if we look at here, the 1970s, the most cited article is the article by Mark Gronovitz, The Strength of Weak Ties. And this is by far the most cited article in American Journal of Sociology. But it's one economic sociological article that has been included in the canon. The others, measuring dyadic adjustment and social change and crime rates trends, for example, are not part of the economic sociological tradition. If we move then to the 1980s, we have a text by Paul DiMaggio, The Iron Cage Revisited, as being the most cited article from the 1980s. And the second most cited article is another article by Mark Gronovetter, the famous one on embeddedness, economic action and social structure. And then there are yet other texts. But it's quite striking that during the 70s and 80s, economic sociology had a few spikes with very, very many citations, indicating that these texts also were not just empirical result, as any empirical result, but they also had an idea that people were picking up on. And this is certainly the case. If we go then to the 1990s, here, 1990s, we find, of the 10 most cited, one economic sociological article, I would claim. This is a text by Brian Utzi, The Source and Consequence of Embeddedness, on the positioning of firms in a network in the garment industry in New York. But certainly not, it's not the leading article, but it's certainly up there. And if we go then to the 2000s, well, there is no article which, so to speak, is to be cited and seen as an economic sociological article. So if we take the big picture again, we see that here, this first one, and then there are a few more, and here it goes back, so to speak. And I think the short story of this is that new economic sociology saw its light here, and people started to quote it, and there were other more sparks here, and then there was one, and then it didn't disappear. I think this is the wrong interpretation. It just became normalized. It became standard science, part and parcel of sociology. But it was not the new thing. It was no longer the new kid on the block, which it was during the 70s, 80s, and to some extent in the 90s. So this very simple analysis, which, I mean, I haven't done it myself. This is John Moody has done the figures of. But I think it illustrates as well, if you want to understand the development of the field called New Economic Sociology and why it is the situation is as it is today and how it emerged. So how is the situation today? If we today were to go through, and I've done so, looking at the leading journals, and by the way, it's also striking here that you see, especially here, you see all the yellow here are American Sociological Review. And then you have American Journal of Sociology, which are the red ones. And here you start to see more variation of the colors. So you see articles actually appearing in different journals. And it's quite interesting also that you may even draw the conclusion that in the past, it was a very, of course, there's a lot of analysis you can do about this in terms of geography, of course. These are the sites. All of these journals are US journals, by the way. So that's the first thing. No surprise. But what we can say is that over time, it appears as if the new ideas do not appear as frequently in the top journals, ASR, American Sociological Review, and American Journal of Sociology, but they tend to appear in slightly smaller journals because of perhaps the mainstreaming and the pressure to format papers in a certain way in the major journals, ASR, AJS. So that's also an interesting insights you may draw, or at least an analysis as a hypothesis. But okay, how is the situation today? If you go through the leading US journals, which still is ASR and AJS, and you will probably also look at Annual Review of Sociology, but there is it's clear that there is a substantial number of texts which I will label, and I think anyone would label them as economic sociological. But hardly of any of these have any form of economic sociological programmatic statements in the text. There is, moreover, few texts that signpost the notion of economic sociology. So the studies published during the last couple of years, or last decade, surely, cover different economic topics. Moreover, it appears as if the connection to distinct schools or traditions of economic sociology today is less pronounced. What we can observe, however, in this text is clearly a sociological analysis of economic phenomena. It's fair to say that if we look at the leading field in economic sociology, which still is the US, research on economic has become, again, perhaps more than 100 years after the most important classic economic sociological texts were published, a topic again. It's mainstream. Studies of the economy today is mainstream sociology. So what we see is much more of articles that deal with parts and pieces of the economy, but few that try to put it into a larger frame or integrate these findings. And given the structure of the US sociology and the increased value put on articles in top journals for getting a job, perhaps especially at the most prestigious institutions in the US, it's most likely that economic sociology, at least the American version of it, will continue to develop in its current direction, in which empirically grounded text, each addressing its own minor issue, will be published. Even if one acknowledges the great many studies and the theoretical advancements, which are according to almost any scale of evaluation, impressive, there's still perhaps a lingering sense that the progress has lost momentum. One reason was pointed out by Richard Swedberg already in 2004, and here I quote, "While economic sociology is lacking a cohesive theoretical core of the type that mainstream economic has, nonetheless has at its disposal a number of concepts that are helpful in untangling the impact that social relations and social structure may have on the economy." So seen in this light, new economic sociology is characterized by two key propositions. First, that economic action is embedded in social structure and or embedded in political process or cultural practices, as we talked about. And second, that the economic system is embedded in society. The key notion, obviously, is embeddedness. And this we see in many of the articles still published. Of course, embeddedness is fine, and one can use it to address problems, but it's not enough to establish a progressive research agenda, primarily because it's not a problem. The only problem is to show how whatever studied is embedded. But this is not a real problem for the actors, nor is it primarily a scientific problem. It's above all a proposition about how sociologists think the world is like. This proposition, both in reality and in theory, is more directly oriented to economic theory, albeit with a critical edge. The both implicit and explicit critique voiced by sociologists is that economic man and economic reasoning is too narrowly defined and does not account for social embeddedness. Most notably is the critique of the individualized economic man. But it's also somewhat paradoxical that many sociologists from Weber to Granovetter and White have largely accepted economic man as the starting point of analysis. Economic sociology has followed Granovetter and not offered an alternative to economic man. Instead, economic man has been theoretically embedded in institutions, culture, norms, or in networks. Though most would probably agree that economic men do not run about unfettered, and though sociologists clearly have shown this, it has been hard to formulate one more coherent theory about this. Moreover, the debate about economic man and embeddedness has been about assumption and conditions, and obviously about explanation, but not about empirical problems. Also, the most prominent economic sociologist, which still is Mark Granovetter, in his very recent book, Society and Economy, Framework and Principles, from 2017, which was a book that people were waiting for decades to be published. So this should be the main statement of economic sociology. He argues that economics and sociology differ on the assumption of man, economic man, that is the economist, versus man as guided by social influences in sociology, or the notion of social embeddedness, which he now uses in a very broad fashion. But what is the problem that economic actors face? Granovetter identifies three levels of economic phenomena to be explained. The first is individual action. Using the Weberian notion of action, he addresses, and I quote, the production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services, what we might call the hardcore of economic activity, end of quote. The second level refers to economic outcomes of individual actions. And the third level refers to economic institutions, which typically involve larger complexes of action. And individuals come to see them as the way things should be done. What Granovetter offers is a set of levels, which are propositions about the world. On these we should ground our explanations of the economy. The approach, however, lacks a problem. It's a more a formal scheme for how to present explanations. It can be concluded, if we conclude the analysis of new economic sociology, that it's still defined as a movement against economics. It is derived from criticizing economics and above all the assumptions of economic man. This has been very fruitful for establishing the field of economic sociology and create some kind of similar ideas about what should be done. But it has not been very useful, I would argue, for furthering the field beyond the point of bringing it together. And towards the problem, my suggestion is that economic sociology should, in contrast to what hitherto has been the strategy, also by leading economic sociologists, namely to discuss propositions and prove them to be true, depart from fundamental problems that are both scientific problems and problems for the actors. There are, of course, many empirical and concrete problems, such as what designers shall we, as a firm of the fashion industry, work with to develop our brand? Or which of our stores shall we close next to adjust to the decreasing sales in our physical stores? These and many others are, of course, real problems for individuals and firms, but they are neither general nor scientific problems. Students of economic sociology may be able to come up with practical solutions to these problems, obviously, but that's not the primary task of science. A scientific problem is more general, and if addressed properly and successfully, many can benefit from the answers provided. A great number of problems meet this requirement. For example, how are networks formed? What happens to people in an economy in which the credit market has become increasingly central in determining life chances? How do markets function? How has inequality in European society developed over the last 50 years? What are personal relationships when are personal relationships detrimental or beneficial for lenders? These are typical problems addressed by economic sociologists. They're real, and the answers are in many cases also of use to actors, people working in industry or individual citizens. My idea is that economics and economic sociology have much in common, and they share a central problem. By addressing a shared problem, it will be much easier to interact and to work together, instead of spilling ink on fruitless trench wars. Put differently, I see the opportunity by identifying central problems that sociology can become more relevant in the larger project of understanding the economy. Is there then such a problem? Uncertainty. Uncertainty, I claim, is the problem that meets the requirement just posed, namely to be both relevant to actors and to be a scientific problem. It may score, I have to admit, lower on the scale of being system critical, perhaps, which certainly is a task that sociology has assigned itself. In the first lecture, I discussed at some length the notion of uncertainty. In this lecture, I only briefly repeat the main ideas. I will focus on uncertainty that is directed at the future, when actors, individuals, and firms make decisions. The problem is to make a choice when there are several different alternatives and the outcomes are uncertain. It is thus a problem of knowledge. More concretely, economic actors may, for example, want to know which product line to develop of those they have, in which stock to invest, or whom to employ to become a member of the marketing team. How can one analyze the uncertainty involved in the process of evaluation of the most creative or talented workers and their output, as well as remuneration, topics which, of course, Pierre-Michel Minger has worked on? I depart from the notion of uncertainty developed by Frank Knight. Uncertainty, to provide a definition, exists in a situation in which, here I quote Kenneth Arrow, we do not have a complete description of the world which we fully believe to be true, end of quote. Uncertainty is present when we cannot know the future consequences of present action. Hence, it is a condition in which we cannot predict or foresee what will happen when acting or not acting, nor what others' action will lead to. This problem is central in economics since it initially was formulated by Frank Knight, and I'm certainly not the first economic sociologist to bring up the notion of uncertainty. Harrison White put it at the core of his analysis, though he was never really explicit about it. Jens Beckett was the first economic sociologist to discuss this in detail, and Riz Azarian has presented it as a common ground for a dialogue between economics and sociology. So what does it mean to focus on the problem of uncertainty? We can, of course, look at the problem from the perspective of the individual actor, the decision maker, who's facing uncertainty. This is the case above all of economics and, of course, of sociology. Or we can do, as I did in the lecture on Monday, focus on public uncertainty reduction. That is, how uncertainty is reduced for many. In both cases, we address the issue of uncertainty, albeit from different ends. Much of the uncertainty, as I mentioned, is due to contingency of others. This suggests that we should not focus solely on the individual decision-making, but on the context in which the contingency arises. A large part of the context is made up of decisions made by others, though not only in direct situations of double contingency, as discussed by Parsons or Luhmann. So what is the primary context relevant to economic sociologists? I will here give some examples from the industry. I argue that the theoretically neutral term industry is useful for giving an account of the context of action under uncertainty. The all contemporary economic activities rest on a bed of institutions. Economic actions are primarily embedded in markets, the dyads that make up networks, organizations, and the specific institutions of the industry in which they take place. This mirrors the statements of Harrison White that markets are embedded in other markets. There are also others who have pointed in a similar direction to the direction I mentioned here. There's a branch of sociology called industrial sociology, which has been to some extent merged into economic sociology, as indicated by the citation of Svedberg above. Industrial sociology is still a field of research. The section Arbeits- und Industriesoziologie is one of the oldest and largest of the German Sociological Association, DSG. But within this field of research, there is clearly an interest in the economy, but a strong focus on work. Topics of work are combined with technological development, and this leads to an analysis also of the work condition and organization of work. The focus is not on specific indices, but on the condition and change of the economy at large. It's rare to see scientific studies that addresses entire industries. There is a branch called industry studies supported by a donation from Sloan. An industry study association is a branch that is practically oriented and aims both at scholarly work and at the development of policies. Some give detailed overviews of different aspects of industries, but without really trying to tie these together. What I suggest does not reject the practice side, quite the contrary, but it cannot be the sole or even the main focus of academic work. It's unlikely that we'll find complete industry studies in the narrowly defined articles that are in fashion today. The research is closer to more encompassing works of classic social scientists like Alfred Marshall. Later approaches like global value chain have discussed industries, or more correctly, production in terms of chains, but often from one-dimensional perspectives. My point is not that we should return to the ideas of industrial social tradition, sociological tradition, nor to the descriptive studies of a field. The notion of an industry, as I see it, refers to the markets and actors who are embedded in one another within an institutional frame that result in a distinct output of something. Thus, though the etymology of industry refers to the diligent use of one's resources and later to the use of machines, it will here refer to a particular branch of systematic use of labor and resources for a specific output. The publishing industry, for example, refers to the change in which those writing, the agents of the industry, the publishers, their employees, the reviewers, and the readers are connected and to one another via markets, labor markets, producer markets, and financial markets, as well as organizations and networks. All of these are embedded in institutions. The questions of uncertainty is made concrete in each link. For example, what publishing house shall I contact to get my manuscript published? The publishing house on its side face another type of uncertainty. What authors should we sign? These two uncertainties are contingent on one another, and any study should then consider both sides. And this has been done, of course, in studies of a matching. But in addition to this type of study that take both sides of a market into account, an industry study continues, as it were, to the next market in both directions. For example, of production and consumption of texts, and tries to see how these links are tied to one another and understand the action of actors in relation to the context, which is then also studied. Moreover, the way uncertainty is reduced by status orders, competitions, and the like are necessary aspects to understand the reality of actors of such an industry. Important are also decided institutions, those setting the conditions for the institution, for the industry, but also those that the industry may set up on its own. For example, using meta-organization, which is typical of an industry that you have an industry association which sets up conditions under which they compete within an industry. There are, of course, plenty of examples of industries. I mean, the cement industry, there's the industry for football, and there's the fashion industry. And there are several different art industries. Each of these industries, there's an output of a distinct and recognizable type. So industries are tangible units for analyzing uncertainty. And each of these units are naturally and primarily embedded in other parts of the industry. In an industry, we find not only individuals, but as said, firms and regulators, most of whom relate to one another via markets downstream and upstream. It is, in my view, these are, in my view, examples that point in the direction of actors who aim to reduce uncertainty. Market actors aim at reducing uncertainty to make better decisions, and they can do this individually, not seldom under competition, or collectively. Actors in the market can choose different ways to reduce their uncertainty, but they're not free. Markets are typically regulated, and the institution in which they are embedded both enable and constrain actors. If we look back at history, the perhaps most well-known strategy to diminish uncertainty has been to reduce competition. To set up an organization that controls competition, that is a trust, was the rule rather than the exception. Guilds are, of course, one typical example of this. To establish ties across markets is another strategy, called clientelism by Clifford Geertz. Put differently, the market, which of course reduces uncertainty to some degree by offering a way of finding supply, demand, and prices out, is seldom pure. More often it's embedded and or organized. Hence, the uncertainty of one actor or a set of actors is always to be related to other twigs or phenomena upstream or downstream in the economy. That's the point of making an industry study or a study of an industry. In this sense, the context of uncertainty reduction is just not external to the researcher, but part of the study. Though industry research, which perhaps is not a very sexy label of what we should do or what can be done, can be done step by step and by individuals, it lends it well to collaborative efforts. Not only does the scope of the empirical research require a large effort, to be able to do this in practice, a high level of scientific work, research from different disciplines most likely would have to collaborate. Moreover, it would, by definition, force us to think more holistically and less piecemeal about problems, but also about the research products and perhaps also about our publications. To understand uncertainty in a context of a whole industry is facilitated by larger research products spanning over an industry and including several research from different disciplines. This is, would also enable generalization, a topic perhaps too large to discuss further here. I have made an attempt to study the fashion industry, and it was reported in a book called Orderly Fashion. I do not mention this book because it was an idle industry study, because I learned how difficult it is and that it requires collaboration. My studies on the fashion industry, and more specifically the branch of industry of the larger retail chain, such as Topshop, Zara, and H&M. The study focuses on markets and traces the market from the consumer market of fashion goods over the producer market for the garments in which these branded retailers face the manufacturers of the garments, often located in countries far away from the goods are sold, to the financial market in which the retailers seek money for investing. In addition, there are, of course, labor markets, and different markets for various input goods that are part of this industry. To me, it's clear that an industry study requires not only focus, but also much effort. Rich data and research from different disciplines to get deep enough about the empirical details, but also to show how the details are contingent on the context. This is much more than what one researcher can accomplish. And let me, before I conclude, mention some aspect from a European perspective that speaks in favor of doing in what I call industry studies or studies of industry. The first is funding. In Europe, in contrast to the US, it's relatively easy, though not easy, to get large research grants, which is almost a requirement to pursue large-scale projects on industry. Moreover, also departments or research units is possible to be set up in Europe. So you can have research groups or laboratories that can work collaboratively on specific industries. These are structural advantages of the European academic milieu. Conclusions. My point in a nutshell is to look at the issue of uncertainty. I talked about this in these two lectures. For decisions of individuals and the reduction of uncertainty in the context of an industry. That would be the task for economic sociology. This is not only the question, of course, that economics, not the only sociological questions that we should address, but it's a guiding question, the question of uncertainty. Obviously, one can study indices without addressing them using the notion of uncertainty, and uncertainty without using the notion of industry. Despite the advantage of studying uncertainty, what I've suggested does not mean that all economic sociologists should concentrate on uncertainty. Sociology is a Grundwissenschaft, or basic science, and as such, it must always be reflexive about its own undertaking, its object of study. Hence, an economic sociology as a discipline that would simply take the current condition for granted would no longer be a discipline about the social. A critical self-reflection is a fundamental driving force for sociology. this, of course, many sociologists and thinkers like Foucault and Bourdieu have discussed profoundly. But by reflecting on our own activity and our own knowledge production, we of course allow us to be critical also of others, including institutionalized conditions like capitalism, but also other actors and institutions. Nonetheless, the advantage is that uncertainty is an empirical real problem. People in the economy are struggling with this problem, and it is a genuinely scientific problem. It would allow economic sociology to create bridges to economics, and to point, and it points at research questions. The question of uncertainty is both relevant to economic actors and social scientists. Above all, it's central to the economy. My conclusion, at its core, comes relatively close to the ideas of Max Weber and Joseph Schumpeter, namely that the different disciplines together should be used to address problems. Schumpeter argued for an economic history, statistics, as I mentioned, and economic sociology should be combined. And Weber talked about this in his Grundriss of the relation between economy and other spheres of society. Weber stressed the combination of law, history, and economics and sociology. But neither Schumpeter, and certainly not Weber, identified a problem that should be put at the center of the research. I'm very grateful that I have had the opportunity to talk to you about the problem of uncertainty and elaborate on the idea of economic sociology. And obviously this is more a statement and perhaps a statement of what I intend to do in the near future. Thank you very much.